welcome to Medea Vox. My name is Dina Henriksen. I am a postdoc at the Crawford-funded research project, the Digital Gothic, here at Malmö University, together with Professor Bo Reimer. So here with me today is Dr. Erika Kvistad from the University of Southeastern Norway. Welcome, Erika.
Thank you so much.
Today we'll be talking about what is sometimes referred to as the Digital Gothic or Digital Horror. And just as like, so everybody's on board with what's that about, because I know you've been working with that genre a lot and really looking forward to talking to you about it for the next 30 minutes or so. How would you, in your own words, define the digital horror or digital gothic?
Well, I mean, I suppose the way I usually talk about this when I'm just like discussing this with people at parties is I just refer to it as horror on the internet as a very broad definition. Which means it can be fiction, it can be kind of people telling stories about things that apparently have actually happened to them, it can be visual art, which of course is, that's how what might be one of the most famous pieces of digital horror, Slenderman, started. You know, it started out as a series of manipulated photos. It can be videos and web series, interactive fiction, digital games. For me, one of the kind of central things in digital horror is that because of its medium, you can, at least in theory, kind of interact with it. It's not just this sort of finished and complete thing that you are an audience for. It has these kind of potentially sort of rough edges that you can grab onto. So obviously a big subset of this is creepypasta, which is a genre with a really stupid name that's about 20 years old at this point, actually. And creepypasta as a term usually refers to stories that are anonymously posted and they on some level pretend to be real. And of course they are creepy in some form. And I think this is kind of very much a concept that's sort of starting to shift a little bit with time. It's more and more common now, I think, to, you know, write a creepypasta story that you put your own name to and that you're not even pretending is true. So what I'm kind of trying to do a little bit in my current work is to start using the phrase hoax horror to denote, you know, this kind of thing. Horror that is, you know, more or less seriously trying to trick you into thinking it's real. And in that sense, you know, a work of traditional creepypasta and a found footage film could both fall into that category of hoax horror. Obviously, it's not the case that all digital horror is pretending to be real in any way. But I do think, and I've kind of, as I've worked on this, I've sort of increasingly started to feel that the hoax is kind of at the heart of digital horror, at the heart of how it works. And I think it has to do with like how things come at us on the internet. You know, often we come across this kind of horror in a context where we're not expecting it. Maybe we're just scrolling Twitter. And it's also often kind of out of context. It's not like we've sort of sat down with, you know, a volume of like Edith Nesbit. It's something that we often see out of the context of its creator. And that means that, you know, things that in an offline context would really obviously be an artistic creation might seem like a historical artifact. Someone who is like role-playing on Twitter or kind of messing around a little bit on Twitter, creating a ghost story might seem like a real person telling a real story. And even if a writer is trying to make it clear that this stuff is fiction, you know, those kind of paratexts can be removed or they can just be overlooked. So I think there's this kind of flow between what we think is real and not, that is, you know, not unique to digital horror in any way, but kind of very much a part of it, a part of its, I don't know, energy.
I'm just really curious about the interconnections between horror and hoaxes and how come that they fit each other so nicely, that even as you say that this is not something that is only happening with horror or on like kind of like gothic storytelling online, it's not unique to it. But there seems to be something about hoaxes and this sort of, let me tell you a story and this is true. And then the horror genre that seems to go together so well. Is it something that you have been looking into? Why do they come together so easily?
It is something that obviously is there, you know, from whenever you want to kind of date the start of horror. But, you know, certainly it's there right from, you know, when you're telling stories around a campfire and you don't say out loud, this is just a fictional story, so there's no need to worry. You know, you present it a little bit as if it is real or might be real. And I think kind of, you know, an obvious answer might just be it makes it scarier. but I think there's something about specifically the experience of being a little bit tricked, a little bit fooled, or on the verge of being fooled, or almost in the mind space to be fooled by a horror hoax that is very different from what you experience when you're fooled by another kind of hoax. I don't know. I mean, of course, some non-horror hoaxes can be very pleasurable as well. But I think often after people find out that a horror hoax is actually fictional, they kind of continue to almost role play that they still believe in it. They don't sort of immediately go, oh, God, I should have realized that. I feel so stupid now. They stay in the mind space. They continue to almost behave as if. So I think it's almost like the horror hoax creates this sort of room for like perceiving the world as potentially more fantastical and more interesting than maybe it really is.
Yeah, no, I really like that. Do you have like a concrete example of like a horror hoax and where people have then got really invested, and even after knowing that, no, it's actually not true, they kept going?
One example that I have worked on a little bit before is Dear David by Adam Ellis. This is a Twitter horror thread. And I think at the time it was maybe the first or one of the first kind of Twitter horror stories that kind of went really big. And it went on for months from 2017 to 2018-ish. You could say in some ways it's technically not finished yet. He's never actually come out and said this isn't true. And it's this, you know, just started with him telling this story about kind of being haunted by a ghost of a little boy with a dented head, and kind of feeling increasingly under threat and increasingly seeing weird stuff happening in his living space. And he, you know, he posts videos, he posts images. There's a lot of work put into it, and people, you know, engage with it. Some of them, of course, saying, oh, this is obviously fake, but many of them engage with it from the start as though it's real, and they give him advice, and, you know, they try to warn him about various things. They express fear, and kind of, you know, because it goes on for such a long time, it becomes this sort of ongoing relationship between the writer and the audience, kind of mutual exchange. And the thing that happens that kind of changes this and sort of shifts the dynamic a little bit is not so much that people start to think, actually, this can't really be real. It's more that it's this point where he announces that he sold the film rights to this. So it's like, it's at that point, it becomes like a finished, closed off story. It's no longer a space that they're playing in together. But, you know, I still like it.
Oh, it's a really good story. Something that interests me is, I mean, obviously, I love all things horror. But one thing is to be a very like big nerd about it. And then there's the question of, but why pay critical attention to these stories? What can they tell us, if anything, about our current moment? Is that something that you consider sometimes? Like, what, why these stories? What do we get from analyzing them? What do we get from engaging with them and looking at how they're being told? Can we unpack them in some ways to get an understanding of our relationship with, for example, technology and that which scares us and contemporary monsters?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you know, it's the answer to why I explore this kind of thing critically is just because I really want to and I seem to be allowed to, which is great for me. I mean, I think that there is obviously this kind of longstanding critical idea about horror and the gothic as something that is always sort of culturally specific in one way or another. It reflects on and kind of obsesses over and twists the things that a particular culture or a particular time are obsessed with. It is about whatever we, you know, whoever we might be, are afraid of. And I think in this sense, digital horror does work as this sort of amplifier for current fears. A lot of digital horror, although definitely not all of it, has a kind of meta quality. So it's not only, it doesn't just come to you in a digital format, it's also kind of about the digital in some way. But whether or not that's the case, you know, obviously there are also digital horror stories that are about like the forest. Even in those cases, the medium, I think, is really important. It's, you know, we're not just kind of reading a scary story. We're getting a scary story in a particular way. And I think digital horror can be a way of sort of experiencing or playing with the kind of unbounded quality of the internet as something that is just, as time goes by, getting closer and closer to us, more and more intimate with us. Kind of, it sort of seeps, it's uncontainable. One obvious place to go with this, I think, is, you know, the connection between the hoaxiness, the pretending to be real, that's kind of inherent, I feel, in digital horror, and, you know, the extremely relevant issue of digital misinformation. I think it's possible to draw connections, you know, very long connections, not at all close connections, but still between this kind of reality play and, you know, conspiracy theories. There's been this one very good essay I read recently that compares alternate reality games to QAnon. And structurally, you know, there's a little bit of a similarity there. And I think it also comes back to, you know, the paradoxical reaction that we have to horror hoaxes, where we kind of want it to trick us. There's this book by the journalist Jack Werner about disinformation in social media. So in English, it translates as, I don't care if this isn't true, it still sucks. And so there is, you know, with digital misinformation, there's that sense of wanting to believe, wanting to continue to believe, even when we know it isn't true, because it fits our preconceptions. And I think the desire to believe in horror hoaxes is like almost the, you know, the creative, or I think kind of beautiful flip side of that, our desire to believe in something that actually kind of shatters our preconceptions.
I think that those are some really important connections. I'm wondering if it also has something to do with how, as you say, the internet and digital media is becoming more inherent to our everyday life, at least if you live in digitalized societies, but also how little we actually know about how they work and how a lot of our digital technologies rely on just making invisible a lot of very complex technical systems that I have no idea how work. And then we have these stories about be careful of your data, be careful of like who is watching you at all times, who is collecting your data, who is watching you. So I think to me it sounds like sometimes these technologies just inherently filled with ghosts because they rely so heavily on the invisible and the deferred and that which I cannot see, but is felt as a presence nonetheless.
Yeah. I think there is this kind of tendency to, for a lot of people, you know, certainly for me sometimes, to feel my connection with the internet and with the digital as a kind of curse, even though it's something I find so interesting and love so much. But there is sometimes this kind of sense when you are extremely online, to use that expression, there's almost a sense that you are not quite steering your own behavior. You are not quite in control of yourself. Like you find yourself, I say you, I mean me, kind of almost without thinking about it, starting to check your phone, almost without thinking about it, like opening Twitter. It's like you are driven by something that isn't quite you. It's as if there is something inside you that isn't quite you. And I think that's something that obviously can be unsettling and can be, you know, depressing or upsetting, you know, in addition to all of the privacy concerns that you describe and the sense of unknowability here. And I think turning these things into horror or dealing with these things in horror, I see as this very, you know, creative and playful response. I see it as a kind of counterforce to that experience of being like feeling a little bit deadened or a little bit taken over by the internet, that instead you can sort of crack it open. You can use that to create a kind of sense of wonder.
I know, and this is something I've been really looking forward to asking you about, because I know you've been doing a lot of research on then what happens when you've made a horror hoax, people have engaged with it, and then some time passes. And in internet years, something like 20 years, for example, is like a lifetime. And sometimes you have these horror hoaxes actually living out there for like decades. So, and you've been doing some research on what happens in the afterlife of a horror hoax. Could you say a few more words about that research?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a thing I have pretty recently finished writing, and it's out on review now, and will hopefully see the light of day before long. Yeah, I think it's kind of an attempt to deal with the fact that, you know, what might kind of initially seem like this very fresh and new and exciting genre and field of study is at this point, you know, pretty much 20 years old, 20 plus years old. And as you say, that is an eternity in digital years. And the way that I kind of wanted to look at that or deal with that was through this a series of YouTube videos that came out in 2007. They're all posted between spring and summer of 2007. It's as a kind of video project, its title is In the Dark. It's directed by Andrew Cull. But of course, that title isn't attached to it in any explicit way. When you look it up on YouTube, the channel is called At Louise Paxton. There are these 38 videos showing a young woman who's just moved to London into a new apartment. She is filming these little diary entries on her little crappy digital camera, kind of to stay in touch with her friends back home. And they are, you know, many of them incredibly boring, superlatively boring. And then, you know, around like, I think it's the 11th one, she is very upset and she is kind of recording, apparently almost for the police, this sort of little statement about having seen a stalker outside her house, having seen some kind of figure that was standing outside her front door and kind of scratching on it. And after that, many, although still not actually all of her videos, kind of shift to being about this attempt to investigate what's going on here. You know, strange things continue to happen. And then the final video is apparently posted by a friend of hers after she has just completely vanished into thin air. And her friend writes, "I don't know what's going on. When I got into the bedroom a few minutes later, Lou wasn't there. Don't understand where she could have gone. This is what was on the tape." So sort of at no point is this presented as a film project. It's presented as, you know, videos uploaded by this young woman. And of course, 2007 is now 15 years ago. I'm trying to do the maths. It's a long time ago.
I'm just relying on you to do the maths. I'm not even trying.
Yeah, you know, we're humanities people.
And we know our limits.
Yes, so when I came across this, you know, just like last year, one of the first things it kind of brought up for me was a sense of nostalgia, because, you know, 2007 was the year I graduated university, which in the UK, it's set in the UK. And there is something really intensely 2007 about it. You know, it's that style of vlogging, the video quality, the sense of kind of how you use social media, like very early social media to interact with people, kind of its cultural touch points to some extent. Like at one point, the Kaiser Chiefs are played, which is like just so specific. This isn't a period piece. It was made in 2007. It's completely contemporary to when it was made. It's just become a period piece now. And so then you might ask yourself, well, you know, I mean, when you're reading Jane Eyre, that's from like 1847. You don't see that as a period piece. You just see it as a classic. You just see it as an old book. But I think it's because when you go on YouTube and you look at these videos, it's like they have this kind of immediacy. It feels like it should be happening now. It feels kind of both weirdly fresh and weirdly stale. It's like, you know, something that hasn't quite been buried. And the other aspect of this, of course, in addition to that sense of strange datedness, is that hoaxes are time limited. Hoaxes are intended to expire at some point, to be found out at some point. If a hoax is designed to never be found out, I would say it isn't a hoax, it's just a lie. And so the question I sort of wanted to ask was, you know, what happens when a hoax has been found out kind of in this slightly ambiguous way by many people, but not all people, when it's lost its kind of immediate power to convince us?
It's such a good way to put it, that there is a feeling of immediacy and that like this should be happening right now since it's on YouTube. And I'm guessing that the algorithms, if you become invested enough in this kind of genre, it will start pushing these videos as well. Even though they were posted in 2007, they will, like, it will be saying, how about having a look at this one or this one? And I know from my, whenever I'm on YouTube and it starts doing this, and I'm surprised if it's just 1 year old or like 2 years old. I'm like, why are you telling me about this video? Because it's so old. But it does create that currency, or that, like, this is happening right now, maybe you should watch it right now.
So I think an interesting thing to think of in this context is what is the viewer doing? What is the audience doing? And the audience is so important to this kind of storytelling. You know, the phrase found footage sort of suggests a narrative that's been pieced together from little bits of, you know, real documentary evidence. But in this case, you know, we are actually the ones piecing it together. We're the ones who look at this kind of pile of occasionally kind of boring evidence and put it together into something like a story. And the way we do that, the way we put together the story and the way we react to and perceive the story, and whether we even see that there is a story at all, that will completely depend on when we come into the hoax. So obviously the experience of seeing this as it was coming out would have been completely different from the experience of seeing it now. So in a way, the earliest viewers of this would have been seeing this as a kind of an encounter with a real haunting, and, you know, potentially evidence of ghosts actually existing, possibly at least. Viewers now, you know, it's still possible to be fooled by it. You know, you're not necessarily, a lot of people will be encountering this through, you know, an article talking about it as a hoax or whatever. But as you say, like, the algorithm could just kind of push it to you and you could just see it sort of naively in a way, like as if for the first time. But I think more and more for present day viewers watching this, they will actually be seeing it as kind of ghostly in a different way to how it was initially ghostly. It was as this kind of, it's almost like a sort of a ruin or a half functioning piece of equipment, something that, you know, at one point was able to trick us and is still kind of trying to trick us, but it's no longer quite able to. It's sort of slightly fallen into ruin. And the kind of the creepiness, I think, that we experience now watching this has to do with the creepiness of that span of time, that distance between us and the hoax. But I think there's also kind of an element of, you know, even if a hoax has mostly stopped working and has been, you know, debunked and revealed, and we all know it isn't true. We all know, you know, that Louise is played by an actress, Zoe Richards. You know, there's still that sense of, you know, what I was talking about when it comes to the unwillingness to quite disbelieve this kind of hoax. And I think it has to do with almost like, it's almost like you're waiting for the third beat. Mm. So like first you get fooled, then it gets debunked. And I almost feel like within the dark, we're still sort of waiting for that final thing to happen where we realize that it actually was true. It's like that kind of, that future where we find that out feels like it might still be in front of us.
I'm really excited about that way to put it, because it does remind me of a typical horror trope. Whenever you watch a horror film, it will try to trick you. Like you hear a sound and then you go and check it and then you find out it was just a dog. And next time you hear the sound, you go like, oh, it's a dog again. But then it's really like actually the monster is there. So there is this sort of setting you up to be fooled and to be tricked. And then you figure out, no, it's not too bad. It was something else. And then just to keep like catch you unawares next time. So this one in this way, the dated horror hooks could be opening up to a future yet to come where the monster is actually there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in, you know, it also has to do with just horror as a genre. I mean, in horror, being the person who refuses to believe in something, even when it seems incredible, that's never a good role to have. You always want to be the person who immediately calls a Catholic priest and just immediately gets the house blessed. You don't want to be going around saying, oh, it's probably just the cat. It's probably just, you know, the house is creaky, it's settling. You know, horror rewards that kind of credulity and that kind of openness to anything.
So your favorite... I asked you about your favorite, like, digital horror or story, and I know you have many, and the one that you brought out was from a website called Eager Falls. So maybe not your favorite, but definitely something that you are returning to these days.
Yeah, certainly my favorite that I haven't already kind of discussed with you in huge amounts of detail. Yeah, this is the one that kind of immediately came to mind for me was the story of the Hirsch camera. It's, as you say, it's on the website Eager Falls, which is basically, it's by Chris Straub, who is a very prolific and kind of prominent creator of really wonderful digital horror in all kinds of formats. He's the creator of Local 58 and of maybe most famously Candle Cove. But Eager Falls is like a series of stories kind of presented almost as a kind of town history. It's all written in this very sort of detached and analytical way where it's almost like he's kind of going through evidence of the various horrible things that happen in this town. And the thing I really like about the Hirsch camera, which is basically just a description of a camera that's on display in this town, it's a very early camera, and it kind of uses a process that hasn't really been used since, and it just describes the extant images that were taken by that camera. And there's something about how I think I kind of just have to leave it for people to read. It's a very short story, but I feel like each image there really counts, and they're all kind of quite indelible. But I mean, an interesting thing about this in terms of what I've been saying about digital horror is that this is, you know, you couldn't at all call this a hoax. It's presented as fiction. It's very clearly fiction. But it definitely partakes of this kind of hoaxy feeling or vibe or element. It still has this sort of slightly documentary found footage feel to it. It's still using this sense that maybe this Eager Falls website is like a little snapshot from an alternate reality where all this actually is real. So for me, it's kind of a wonderful example of the kind of the edges of this kind of genre.
It's a really interesting website with a lot of really good stories, and I know that it's possible to buy the stories as well if you want to support Chris Straub, the author. Thank you so much, Erica, for being here today and talking to us about digital horror and digital gothic. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for listening.